Our presentation today is Lucy Stone, an American original, by another American original, Robin Proud. Robin has been a UU for over 40 years. She regularly speaks at Prairie, and some of your speak talks are some of my favorite talks. I learned so much. And also at the Free Congregation of Sauk County, about lesser-known figures from our UU history and their relevance for us today. Please join me in welcoming Robin.
Well, everyone recognizes Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton as leaders of the American women's suffrage movement, and that's partly because they literally wrote the book on the subject. But there's another woman who was at least as famous in her time, who broke ground in multiple areas. She's less known today, and that's Lucy Stone. In her time, she was so famous, or infamous, that supporters of women's rights were called Lucy Stoners. She extended her quest for equality into all areas: women's dress, marriage, property rights, and equal pay. She also insisted on fighting for abolition and civil rights at the same time as women's rights, and that led to friction sometimes with both of those movements. As usual, it was a new book that encouraged me to take on this topic. In 2021, this novel, Leaving Coy's Hill by Catherine Sherbrooke, came out. It's a fictional story of Lucy Stone's life. I followed it up by reading the more scholarly Lucy Stone, An Unapologetic Life by Sally G. McMillan. And I found that although Sherbrooke, of course, added conversations and emotions to the historical record, overall the novel is quite close to historical events. Now, many of the people I've talked about we hadn't even heard of. In this case, many of us recognize the name, but we really don't know anything about her life. When Lucy Stone was born to a Massachusetts farm family in 1818, her mother Hannah supposedly said, "Oh dear, I'm sorry it is a girl. A woman's life is so hard." Hannah knew what she was talking about. Lucy was the eighth of nine children to grow up on a 400-acre farm. Although we have few details of Lucy's childhood, she had vivid memories of how hard her mother worked. This family valued basic education for all the children. They also were strong abolitionists, and Lucy was very impressed by women that she heard speaking in public. And I think on the next slide we have a rather formidable looking pair. These are the Grimke sisters, looking a bit grim. And there was another speaker named Abby Kelly. They were touring anti-slavery speakers. But this was a time when women speaking in public at all was often frowned upon. In fact, the Congregational Church, which Lucy's family attended, issued a pastoral letter denouncing these speakers with a famous quote from St. Paul, "Let the women keep silent in the churches, for it is not permitted to them to speak." Lucy had already found herself questioning many of the things she heard in church, and now she said, "If I ever had anything to say in public, I should say it, and all the more because of the pastoral letter." There's a story that Lucy was shocked to discover that when her older sister married, the new husband could sell off her sister's favorite horse, since all the property was now his. This was the doctrine of femme couverte, meaning the husband covered or took over legal and financial rights of the woman. This was one of the reasons that Lucy decided at a young age that she would never get married. Although the family sent two of her brothers to college, higher education for women was practically unheard of. But on the next slide, you'll see Oberlin College. Oberlin began educating women as well as black students. Still, Lucy had to save up her meager earnings teaching in one-room schools. It took her till the age of 25 to save up enough. And while in college, she had to take on jobs such as teaching, doing housework, and mending clothes of other students. She also taught at a town school for free blacks. She had to work these in with time for attending classes and studying. There was no possibility of taking the time or money to return home. During her sophomore year, Lucy was surprised to receive a letter from her father with an offer of money. He wrote about how hard he had worked in a tannery as a young man and how disturbed he was to learn that Lucy was getting up at 2 a.m. to study. He offered to pay for her tuition, room, and board. However, Lucy preferred to borrow from her sisters and brother, only taking money from her father her senior year. Oberlin was a very small institution. There were 34 men and 7 women. Lucy's closest friend was Antoinette Brown, called Nettie. While Nettie was on her way to Oberlin, an upperclassman on the same train warned her about Lucy. They said she held wild and radical ideas on religion and other subjects. So Nettie couldn't wait to meet Lucy. She was surprised to find Lucy was a small and very young-looking figure. When Lucy shared her goal to be a public speaker on abolition, Nettie explained that she wanted to become a minister, something also unheard of for a woman, which she did later achieve. Once she left home, Lucy rarely attended church. At Oberlin, there were required classes and lecture on religion. Lucy's daughter later wrote, "The long discussions on the Trinity, quote, made her a Unitarian." In a letter to her brother, she wrote, "I have not changed my views of church, ministry, Sabbath, or matrimony in the least." And I find with a lot of these women from the 18th and 19th century, they, in their personal views, went way beyond what the structures even of the Unitarian Church were saying at the time. As graduation approached, Lucy competed in writing an essay, and she was the winner. The professor announcing this then told her, "You have the opportunity to select the male classmate of your choosing to read it for you at graduation." Lucy petitioned to read it herself, but she was told, "The college will simply not allow the spectacle of a woman speaking in public." So Lucy refused to allow the essay to be read at all. By chance, her story came to the attention of two people. And well, it's on the next slide. They happened to be attending the graduation and asked to meet her, William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass. Well, they had been heroes in the abolitionist home of Lucy's family. Garrison asked Lucy to become a traveling lecturer for his anti-slavery society. Now, you might remember from some talks I've given on people like Frances Watkins and Caroline Dahl how rudimentary the travel arrangements were at the time. Trains were noisy, dirty, and smelly. Many of the towns had no train service, requiring journeys in various kinds of carriages and wagons in all weather. Local hosts sometimes provided rooms that were of questionable safety and cleanliness. Some of the hosts were downright hostile, and many of the audiences. And Lucy's own family disapproved of her public speaking career. They were abolitionists, but they could not get used to the idea of a woman speaking in public. From the beginning, Lucy was determined to speak on both abolition and women's rights, even though this meant she was paid less by the Anti-Slavery Society. Now, Lucy did not attend the famous Seneca Falls meeting that launched the suffragist movement, but on the next slide, we'll see Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who specifically recommended hiring Lucy to speak on behalf of the movement. And the biographer Sally McMillan states, "Within 3 or 4 years, Lucy became one of the most recognized names in America. By the early 1850s, Lucy was earning hundreds of dollars a year, a considerable income, particularly for a woman." And this was impressive because these other women that I wrote about often barely made enough money to cover their travel costs. In spite of her small stature, Lucy apparently had the ability to command a room and induce people to listen. She included in her talk stories of individuals, such as enslaved women, to increase the audience's engagement. She became a standard organizer and speaker at many conventions on women's rights and abolition. And the biographer says, by the 5th National Women's Rights Convention in 1854, Lucy had become the acknowledged leader of the movement. And let's see, we have another slide here about conventions. So this is a cartoon making fun of them. And it says something about the session. The orator of the day denouncing the lords of creation. It's sort of mocking pictures here. On the next slide, you'll see Susan B. Anthony. Susan and Lucy became close friends. As single women, they had more in common than with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was married with multiple children. And they both experimented with a new style of dress, which you'll see on the next slide. They gave up corsets They wore loose frocks with bloomers underneath. However, the audiences and press fixated so much on the clothing instead of the message that both women decided to return to traditional fashions. Now, how many people have noticed in coverage of female politicians even today, there's a lot of discussion of what they're wearing. There was only one man who dared to challenge Lucy's refusal of marriage, and he did so on her terms. On the next slide, we'll see Henry Blackwell. Oh, maybe not. This is Lucy at the time. There we are. Now, Henry already had a non-traditional view of women's role since his sisters, Elizabeth and Emily, had become the first two women doctors in the United States. And I did talk about them a couple of years back. So Henry admired Lucy. He agreed with all her views. He became a friend and an assistant in her work, writing to her, helping her arrange the tours. And he told her that he wanted a marriage of equal partners and mutual support. He wanted her to keep her own property, income, and name, which was totally unheard of. It wasn't easy for Lucy to overcome her distaste for the legal ramifications of marriage. And she wasn't totally convinced of Henry's commitment. Until he took dramatic action. This seems like something out of a rom-com, that you have to do something to prove your devotion. Abolitionists found out that a slave-holding couple with a young enslaved woman would be passing through Salem, Ohio by train. Hundreds of abolitionists assembled, but Henry was the first to board. He asked the girl if she wished to be free. When she said yes, he picked her up and passed her off the train. This open defiance of the fugitive slave law caused Southerners to accuse Henry of robbery and call for his arrest. But Lucy was impressed by his action. Ironically, Henry's sisters, Elizabeth and Emily, were not supporters of suffrage and never quite approved of Lucy. This might have been social snobbery since she was from a working-class farm family. At their wedding, Lucy and Henry issued an official protest. They stated that they refused to follow any laws that would diminish the wife's rights. And Lucy did not change her name. She also didn't adjust her busy schedule after marriage. In the fall of 1856, she went as far west as Racine, Milwaukee, Madison, and Janesville. Wisconsin was also one site of Henry's land investments, which ended up paying off well for the family. In fact, in 1856, the couple briefly settled in Viroqua. And it says at that time it was a town composed of some 30 shanties located in an area where Henry held 6,000 acres of land. Traveling across 250 miles of frontier to get there was a challenge. Living there proved even more of one. So this is what the biographer was writing about them. They found themselves removed from any cultural stimulation and far from people with whom they shared anything in common. Now, Viroqua is probably a lot of Norwegian immigrants at the time. To her father, in letters, Lucy described the beauty of the land and the abundant wildlife, yet also wrote that she was miserable because settlers were so indifferent to abolition and to women's rights. They were probably just trying to survive. After a few weeks, the couple gave serious thought to moving east, and Henry admitted they had grown weary of this, quote, slipshod, scrambling, dissipated Western life. By fall, they moved back to Massachusetts, and the next spring, they purchased a farmhouse in New Jersey. As a married woman, Lucy was eager to become a mother. It took her almost a year to become pregnant, and she continued to work for her causes as long as she could. When she stopped traveling to speak, she still kept organizing upcoming women's rights conventions. Her daughter, Alice Stone Blackwell, was born in 1857, which focused Lucy at home. And I think there's a picture of her with the baby. However, only 2 months after the birth, Lucy made headlines in a new way. She refused to pay her local taxes. She claimed it was taxation without representation. The town constable seized enough of her household goods to pay the tax and put them up for auction. But Lucy had already planned with a sympathetic neighbor that he would buy them at the auction and she would then pay him back. The New York Times criticized the whole affair as a publicity stunt. When Susan B. Anthony wrote to Lucy complaining about the hardships of life on the circuit, Lucy replied, "You are tired with 4 months' work. If you had measles and whooping cough added to all you have done, it would not be half as hard as taking care of a child day and night. Lucy had no nearby relatives, and Henry was often traveling for his real estate business. Henry was away the following year when Lucy miscarried a boy at 7 months pregnant. This was in 1858, and soon national events would overshadow personal tragedies. During the Civil War, women's rights organizations put their campaigns on hold, and many of their members worked on relief and health efforts for the Union. The war did bring one benefit to Lucy and her small family. Wartime inflation led to the couple making a large profit from bonds and real estate. By the early 1870s, they had a net worth equivalent to almost $1 million in today's money. So this was very different from many of the activists I have talked about before. The big question after the war was how to advance the rights of the newly emancipated Southerners and the rights of women. Susan B. Anthony and others assumed that the amendments giving the vote to blacks would say all citizens, which would mean men and women. Lucy and Henry traveled to Washington, D.C. to try to convince Charles Sumner to remove the word male from the amendment. When the 14th Amendment only mentioned men, suffragists felt betrayed. Lucy and Henry went back on the speaking circuit. Lucy was worried that she had lost her oratorical skills, but was happy to write to Anthony, "I speak as well as ever, thank God." Still, one man said if his wife wanted the vote, he would have, quote, pounded her to death. And others spread rumors that Lucy and Henry advocated free love. There was then a split in the women's movement. Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Reverend Olympia Brown, who has a church named after her here, they allied themselves with a flashy figure named George Train. He was a suffragist, but he was also an unstable and showy figure and an open racist. But my understanding is he got a lot of attention and media time, for just like we see today. And around this time, even Susan B. Anthony started to talk about how unfair it was that ignorant immigrants and uneducated black men should have the vote while cultured white women didn't. Susan B. Anthony and her supporters refused to support the 15th Amendment, while Lucy accepted that the life or death plight of black men in the South demanded immediate action. And Lucy could not accept disrespecting the black issue in favor of the women's issue. So when Susan B. Anthony and her cohort started the National Women's Suffrage Association based in New York, Lucy Stone created the American Women's Suffrage Association based in Boston. All this travel and stress was bound to affect Lucy and Henry's marriage. On an extended trip to Florida, Henry spent a lot of time with a Mrs. P, but nobody knows how far that went. Throughout their marriage, Lucy and Henry spent long stretches of time apart. They were both committed to their political and business ventures. In 1870, Lucy tried to improve what we would now call work-life balance by switching from traveling to writing. She moved to Boston and started a newspaper. She hoped that this new paper, the Woman's Journal, would give her a way to contribute to the movement and live with her family. The reception of the paper was mixed. There were many compliments, but the New York Tribune predicted the paper's early demise. Now, Lucy retorted, the only way to stop the Woman's Journal is to give women suffrage. Although Lucy did travel less, she not only wrote large parts of this journal, but she did fundraising, advertising, sales, and subscription management. She continued to publish this newspaper for the rest of her life. And her daughter, Alice Stone Blackwell, joined the staff herself after graduating from Boston University. The paper never made money, and Lucy took no salary, so she and Henry supplied funds from their real estate profits. Let's see where we are here. Lucy continued to be active in the American Women's Suffrage Association, and her biographer states, while she only served as president in 1872, Lucy led its executive committee and played a pivotal role in organizing annual conventions, rallying members, raising money, and working on state suffrage campaigns. She attended every convention until her health made travel too difficult, and these conventions were as far away as Minneapolis, Omaha, and Topeka. At the 1870 convention, the split between Lucy Stone and Susan B. Anthony widened. Susan B. Anthony stood up to question why Lucy Stone's organization didn't work for changes in divorce laws and women's property rights. And she said Lucy should be backing that because she had refused to submit to the legal form of marriage. Lucy's supporters felt this was a personal attack, that Lucy's marriage was as legal as any. Anthony apologized, but the harm was done. Susan B. Anthony may have been jealous of the success of Lucy's journal, since her own attempts at a paper had failed. She made statements about how weak the journal was and went along with perennial claims that Lucy's faction endorsed free love. Of course, we never hear that now, do we, saying that a particular media outlet is failing and some personal critiques of whoever is in charge. So this hostility endured a long time. At one event where Susan B. Anthony was present, as Lucy was collecting donations in a hat, she raised the hat when passing Susan, saying, "I don't want any of your money, Miss Anthony." While Susan insisted on dropping in a half dollar, Lucy snapped, "At least you can be sure you give it to a good cause." So it's quite sad, because these two people had been close friends and allies early in life, and they still wanted the same basic goals. And just about every social action movement I could think of has had various rifts, either of personality, approach, philosophy, and so on. This rift contributed to Lucy's work being largely omitted from the book that Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote. In 1876, there was a centennial celebration of the United States in Philadelphia. At first, Lucy refused to take part. She said it was shameful that on our nation's 100th anniversary, women are politically and legally still in a bad place. Finally, she agreed to submit a small exhibit 2 feet square about tax protests by women. But when visitors told Lucy they couldn't see her exhibit, she discovered the box had been placed on a high shelf where nobody could perceive it. Mrs. Gillespie, who was in charge of the Women's Pavilion, told Lucy this protest was unsuitable to this time and place. So, from the biography, in reading about Lucy's life and her relentless fight for justice, it is hard to fathom how she sustained her spirit and dedication to a movement that lasted so long and stirred so much opposition. And she got involved in many state campaigns because there were two prongs. Some people were working to get suffrage in specific states. Some were working on the national cause, or both. Yet her belief in the cause of women's suffrage never flagged. It was to her the bedrock of her existence, forming and informed by her character. It was little less than a form of religion, providing her with a way of reconciling herself to the world and making it better, that gave her the strength to pursue the endless campaign for women's suffrage despite crushing results and the many men and women who were indifferent or opposed to the cause. It was her strength and courage that often inspired others. Lucy once said, "It is because I have this quiet faith in the certain triumph of the right that I am entirely undisturbed by anything which venom and ill nature can do." And the biographer Macmillan goes on, "As has become clear, Lucy was a far more complicated individual than she appeared to the public and to the hundreds of suffragists who admired her. She straddled a place in two worlds. In private, someone bound by traditional ideas as a wife and mother, versus her embodiment as a modern, very public woman campaigning to create a truly just nation. Lucy could not have been easy to live with, so determined, moralistic, and occasionally self-righteous. Lucy drove herself relentlessly in pursuing her dream for this country, but often left little time for quiet, reflective moments alone and with her family." And this is very common when we have people who were dedicated in the sciences, the arts, inventions, and so on. Here's a couple of pictures of Lucy and Henry later in life. In 1874, at the age of 55, Lucy was suffering from rheumatism, which made both walking and writing difficult. When her sister-in-law, Emily, the doctor, diagnosed both bronchitis and pneumonia, Lucy was finally forced to take some time off. It wasn't until 1887, when Lucy was 68 years old, that Lucy and Susan B. Anthony met to discuss uniting their two women's rights groups. It was not a harmonious process. There were many disagreements over who should lead and even over the movement's history. It took 2 years for the merger to be completed. In 1893, after a speaking appearance at the Chicago Exposition, Lucy became very ill with what turned out to be stomach cancer. She continued to write letters and receive guests in support of the great cause, practically up until her death in October 1893. And her daughter Alice, who we'll see in the next slide. No, this is all right. This is the family portrait. Her daughter Alice reported that Lucy's last words to her were, "Make the world better." In typical iconoclastic fashion, Lucy stipulated that her body was to be cremated, which was a rare choice at the time, in order to avoid wasting space on Earth. And it was to be another 27 years before the 19th Amendment passed, witnessed by her daughter, Alice Stone Blackwell, who herself was a constant figure in the movement. She did not have any more children. So she had the daughter, and then she had the miscarriage, which probably, in the fictional book, it has her all alone when this happened, which is quite likely. She didn't expect to go into labor so early, and there may not have been a midwife or neighbor around to help, and she doesn't seem to have had any children after that. Some of the issues of temperance and prohibition seem a little silly to us now, how crazy things were during prohibition, or how silly it was to try to forbid this altogether. But what the women who were campaigning saw was men who were drinking their whole paycheck and having nothing left to feed their kids, or drinking, coming home, and beating their wife and kids. So it was really the drug issue of the day. And there were many women who were working for both causes, for both suffrage and abolition. And the brewers knew this, so that's why, for instance, in Milwaukee, the beer companies were campaigning against women's suffrage, because they were afraid that if women got the vote, prohibition would come in, which is actually what happened. Asking about England and Europe. I don't think Europe had as much action, but in England there was definitely a parallel track. And so this was through the 19th century and early 20th century, the Pankhursts were somewhat radical. They were the ones that started chaining themselves to a building or a fence. They had hunger strikes in prison and forced feeding, so some of that came from there. And Alice Paul, who was of the next generation, brought back to America some of those techniques. And again, it's the same thing you will see in other, in civil rights movement, for instance, that some people said, all this going along and trying to work within the system is not helping. We have to do things that are more dramatic. And now you've got people who have decided that it will help the climate cause get attention if they throw things at famous paintings. People want to get attention to their causes. But there was definitely that split in the movement, too, between those who wanted to work within the system and those that wanted something more radical. And in England, there was a definite group that went for the more radical approach. And next week at SOC, I'm presenting something about the activist life, how a number of women who were involved in suffrage learned not to be afraid of things. Oh, I can speak in public. I can go to jail. I can do all these things. And so I can do something else, like become a painter or a scientist or go into politics. So even though women did not turn out to vote in overwhelming numbers in the first few elections, many of them had changed their views on what kind of role they could have in society, and then went on to take that into education, the arts, and all sorts of fields.